things can, and they will, change. Thank you very much.
I'm Jeremy Corbyn, and welcome to the PJP podcast, where we have a guest who talks about their work, their life, and their experience, and we share ideas. It's about creativity, and it's about imagination. And so today we've got with us Rao Reynolds. Rao is the front man for a wonderful band called Enter Shikari. In his music, he develops ideas, he develops thinking, and he talks about causes and his own political views and social justice views as well at the same time, which I think is a great combination. And he's very kindly come along to our office here today to have a chat with us about it. So first of all, Rao, first question, why is the band called what it is?
It's called what it is because my uncle had a small boat. He was a fisherman a long time ago. And he had every boat that he's had throughout his life, he's called Shikari, Shikari 1, Shikari 2. So growing up...
Well, like Queen Elizabeth 1, Queen Elizabeth 2, that
exactly.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
Same kind of principle. Is it smaller?
Was yes. Boat smaller? Yeah, yes, okay. A fair bit. It's probably smaller than the lifeboat on that one. But yeah. And so that word has just always been sort of with me throughout my life. And I used it in all kind of creative ways. I wrote a play about a character called Shikari when I was in year eight or something like that. And so it felt like the band name to be called Enter Shikari. It means the hunter in various Punjab languages. And I thought that was quite apt because, you know, we're all about not hunting for meat, shall we say, but like hunting for like new ideas, for progression. It felt like a interesting.
And so before you develop music, do you then think of the issues you want to talk about as well? Or is the music something that's imaginative and separate from your obviously very thought out and strong political views?
There isn't really like a set kind of structured routine. I think sometimes, more often than not, I suppose, the music will come first. There'll be some kind of spark of an idea and there'll be an emotional undertone to it. You'll already be sort of envisaging what you could perhaps be singing about in terms of a theme or a topic. And it sort of just kind of falls into place in a weird world. The music sort of comes to you and then you kind of channel in whatever you think based on the emotion, I think.
And what's the most recent commentaries, ideas you've added into the music you're doing?
All sorts, really. So our last album, Nothing Is True and Everything Is Possible, kind of took a swing at everything going on in the world from it talks about possibility, human possibility, human potential. It looked at the far future and it looked at like the kind of trajectories that we're on. And no matter which sort of big metric you measure, whether it's like biodiversity, whether it's like community and social interaction and social trust, everything seems to be dwindling and going sort of downwards, which is, you know, quite frightening. So we wanted to look at that and kind of present new ways of thinking, try and like encourage our fan base to take a step back from, you know, the intensity of everyday life and trying to look at everything from more of a broader perspective, look down on things and try and see what we can.
And do the fan base react to this with sort of social media messages and emails and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, we're incredibly lucky. You know, we've been doing this for 15 years and we've had a fan base that's grown and are so passionate and are so kind of, you know, with us in terms of the messages and they're inspiring us to kind of keep going, keep searching and keep. You
know. And do they feel inspired by this or is it a revelation to them? When you're talking about biodiversity, I've not very often heard any musicians talk about biodiversity, but it's obviously crucial to the survival of all of us.
I mean, it's not exactly your standard like rock and roll topic, I suppose.
Well, it's not a standard political topic either. You'll love this. When I ran for leader of the Labour Party in 2015, I wanted to emphasise biodiversity in my environmental message. And somebody said, can you please not talk about bees anymore? I said, why not? They said, well, nobody's interested. I said, well, they ought to be. So I went out and did another speech about bees.
well done, you. Yeah, I mean, I think people are often just like, they're kind of put off by words like biodiversity.
It's a terrible word.
Yeah, everyday person, they don't, you know, even know like what it means, you know, let alone what we need to do to like, you know, improve it. But I think I sort of see our part of our mission as a band to like make people think about these things, because you know we're also bogged down being barraged every day by just like novelties and trivialities and you know everything that we have in our own life, which can be so intense, and we very rarely think about like big ideas, like you know where is our species going at the moment, things like that. So I think it's like a good way of like injecting, you know, a broader perspective into.
And a lot of music and musicians are identified in the mainstream media as conspicuous consumption, personally very wealthy, driving even bigger cars than the next person, et cetera, et cetera. And so that kind of thought process often doesn't appear. But you're saying you've got this whole following, which are are they educating themselves or are you educating them, or do they come to you, attracted to you because they know what your views broadly are?
I think it's a bit of all of that, and also they're educating us. It's very much a community, you know, like audiences or like fandoms, as they're called, of bands are communities. They're like microcosms of society. So there's not only, you know, the sharing of information, there's also the kind of social support framework, really. You know, these are like actual communities, and even on a global level, you know, you have people exchanging information with people, whether it's just about our music or broader things, from one side of the world to the other, people they'd never normally meet. So it creates this really nice sort of cosmopolitan sort of bubble, I suppose.
I find at the moment a lot of people are very frightened. They're depressed and frightened because of lockdown and pandemic and what that did, particularly to young people. When they think about it, they feel disempowered and frightened about environments. They read headline figures, COP26, etc., and they feel powerless to intervene. And now with this ghastly war going on, they feel frightened as well. Mm. And so giving messages out is very important, but it's also important not to frighten and disempower people. It's about empowerment of people as to what they can do, because we're brought up in a society that fundamentally makes us spectators in our own future rather than participants in our own future.
Yeah, it's you have to walk a fine line between like trying to inject a sense of like togetherness and like action and hope, as well as like trying to be realistic. Like I don't really like music that's just pure escapism. You know, obviously we all like, we need like complete escapism every now and then, but like personally I like writing music that's...
So what music do you listen to escape then?
All sorts, really. I was quite lucky to be brought up with all kind of musical influences, so everything from like classical to post-rock, which is quite sort of dreamy and immersive. But yeah, and then, and also I write as well to escape as well. That's, you know, it's a lot of artists talk about how cathartic the experience of like writing music is.
So in the current fear that a lot of people have over war, we've been through in the last 20 years, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and now Ukraine. I find all of this, at one level, depressing, but vile, what's happening to people. We don't want to bring up a generation that's been brutalized. You want to bring up a generation that can form some opinions that can help to bring about a more peaceful future.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the fact that there is like these communities being formed around music, around, you know, like scenes, you know, effectively. And especially like punk not, genres are so sort of dead now, they're all, you know, mixed in together, but like at least the punk rock mindset has sort of survived, where it's very DIY. It's very, you know, the bands are on the same level as the audience. You can create those kind of ways of abilities to communicate with people, and have a sense of unity and a sense of, you know, all of this hell can be happening in the world, but we can still like create bonds. We can do little things. We can chip, do our own, you know, bit to chip away at the various problems and just concentrate on what you can do. That seems to be like the only way to stay sane, really, like look at what is in your power. And it, you know, even putting like a smile on someone's face is like a revolutionary act at the moment. Like, it's a, I think like there's so much that, you know, people can do to escape, but also to help progress in some way.
Well, music is something that has the power to inspire. And this is probably quite sad, really, but I listen to quite a lot of classical music at home when I'm writing and working and stuff. And if something comes on, say Appalachian Spring, Copland, or something from Shostakovich and so on, comes on, and it's introduced by the name Appalachian Spring, obviously. Now, I know what it means, I know what it's about, and I've listened to it hundreds of times. I quite like it. If nobody had told me what it was called and decided this was about spring coming, would we see it as that if we'd listened to it for the first time?
I think everyone would probably have their own slight variation of what it means to them. Yeah. Like music is a, I like to think of it, you know, and it's very hard to think of it this way within capitalism, but like as a gift, like you sort of, you make something and then you just put it out into the world and then people take it and they kind of project into it. You know, they listen to it and they'll have, it will make them feel something. It'll make them perhaps nostalgic for something. And it becomes theirs, you know, and it can mean whatever they want it to mean to a certain extent.
Well, that's how it should be. And art should be there for all and shared for all. It's rather like doing an abstract painting and refusing to name it. Just saying, there it is. They say, what does it mean? No idea.
You decide.
You decide.
Yeah.
So what about your latest work? How's it going?
I felt like a bit of an anomaly during the pandemic. Like, I found it quite difficult to write. So, you know, I was seeing all my peers in the studio being super productive because we were all locked away. And I...
What, you were at home doing nothing? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I was writing a book. So that's
a reasonable excuse.
Yeah. But like musically, I found it really difficult. And I think it was because I didn't have the sort of fuel of the live arena. So like, you know, performing and feeling that human connection, feeling the sort of, you know, the cyclical energy of a room when you're playing and you have people singing back at you with the same passion that you're performing with. All of that to me is like, it really is fuel. And so when that was cut off, I was like, oh God, like I don't know what to write. You know, there was no validation. I sort of felt that my purpose went a bit. So it's only in the last sort of few months that I've started feeling much more at ease with the writing process and writing again and working on the next album, which will...
Do you find it hard to write on your own, or do you prefer sort of pressure and noise and fuss around you at the same time?
I think they both have their benefits. Like, I think if it's like a real, you know, a song that has a real sort of depth to it, then I think I need to be alone. I have to sort of really immerse myself in it. And because writing can be a very emotional process, so you're sort of, to be in touch with, you know, that side of yourself, you can't have too much like distraction, I suppose, or it becomes really difficult to...
But it must be quite difficult to say, well, okay, I'm free, but nothing on next Tuesday, so I'll write then, because it might not take your fancy on Tuesday morning when you get up, you know.
Yeah, I find it, there's, it seems to be like two trains of thought. One is like, you turn up every day as a songwriter or as a producer, and it's a sort of grueling process. And then there's, you know, the glimmer of inspiration every now and then, and then you follow that route and you make a song. And then there's the other sort of train of thought, which is you know, don't chain your muse to a treadmill or whatever, you know, don't like be there every day, just live your life. And then when you have the sort of spark of inspiration, then write. I don't really know where I sit. I'm sort of in between those two. I think there's a middle ground, hopefully, that I'm sort of
doing. It doesn't really matter where you sit, as long as you're comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did you have a concert cancelled in Moscow? Is that right?
We've just cancelled ours. Yeah, so we were playing Park Live. I mean, it's essentially a quite sort of performative isn't the right word, but you know, it's an obvious thing because we wouldn't even be able to get.
You wouldn't be allowed to get there anyway. So
it's clearly not going ahead. But
probably cancelled for you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's important to, you know, show some small element of solidarity, which we can do. But it's just so unfortunate.
But then post this war, we need to show solidarity with the anti-war people in Russia as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And yeah, I've been speaking to quite a few of our friends out there who've, you know, one particular has been arrested twice already. And there is such a sense, like, especially within the youth, that this is not what they want. This has nothing to do with them. This is outrageous. And yeah, so it's horrible because that was a great place for us to go and meet people and play, and same as Ukraine. Like, we have so many friends in both these places, and to see this happen is just hard.
I was talking to some young people on the phone in Moscow yesterday, and they were just shocked, appalled, frightened. And then, I mean, we go to demonstrations, and we don't go to a demonstration with the expectation that you will not come home that night. We go to a demonstration with the expectation that we'll say our piece, do our thing, and go home. Some of them are getting 10 years in prison just for going on a demonstration. And so it takes a lot of courage to do that.
Yeah. 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 Massive.
But they're still doing it, thousands and thousands of them.
Yeah.
And that, well, if that helps to bring an end to the fighting and end to the war, well, that's fantastic. I hope so. Your perspectives on humanity, what are they for the future?
Well, I mean,
because you mentioned it when you were saying about music, you talk about issues, biodiversity, and where humanity is going. I feel often excited by people I meet doing inspirational things, often in very unusual and unlikely places. But I also feel very angry that we don't seem to learn the lessons of environmental disaster, or the lessons of what the COVID pandemic showed about health inequality. And we're heading down a road which is once more a very divided world. Divided economically as well as in other ways.
Yeah. And, you know, it's all completely linked, I think, as well. But the future is fascinating because if you think about it, you know, our species, if we zoom right out, our species has been, you know, alive, what, 200,000 years. Our ancestor Homo erectus had 2 million years. So we've lived, it's like 15% or something of that. So we're like, as a species, we're in our adolescence. We're like a young species working out, you know, its environment.
Incredibly badly behaved adolescents, aren't we?
Absolutely. We're still working it out, I think, and working it out quite badly with putting some bad systems in place that don't respect the one environment that we have, the planet. You know, we've created an economic system which is incredibly misaligned. It has no inbuilt mechanism of recognizing, you know, resources, recognizing the environment that it's being used in. So it's completely disconnected. So I think, you know, there's amazing potential as a species. If we start to realize this sense of stewardship for our planet, then if we look into the far future, we could outlast Homo erectus and all mammalian species. The way that we're combining with technology, when you look into the far future, we really could be like a sort of guardian of this planet and the species on it. But yeah, as you say, there's a lot of sort of systems and structures and frameworks in place now which are quite archaic.
I found some of the stuff at COP26 appalling, the sort of levels of corporate greenwash and the lobbying that was going on. It was at the levels of absurdity. I mean, there's a company there who are trying to build a new waste incinerator around here, were lobbying COP26 to be allowed to build incinerators. Where do you begin? Mm-hmm. But on the other side of it, what I found inspiring was the numbers of people that came from all over Scotland, obviously, but all over the world as well, who were seriously campaigning for a green industrial revolution, for climate justice, and saying you have to have system change to stop climate change, which I absolutely agree with. So I was inspired by that, but also the way it reached beyond protest. And so some people might say the waste disposal system in Glasgow is not sustainable. It's not. They are mostly men who collect the rubbish from people's homes and put it in a truck and take it away, are not obvious allies of the environment movement. Yet, all the, particularly the young people who are in Glasgow, joined them in their strike, joined them in supporting them. And the refuse workers fully understood all that, and they wanted to work in a more sustainable way. They wanted reuse, recycling, and all that. So it seemed to me there was a kind of economic lesson going on there as well at the same time.
Yeah, we actually got to play up there during COPs, and then I could, there's a couple of climate scientists that we know who have been a massive inspiration. They took me around it, and it was an incredible, you know, mixture of, you know, you walk into one room and there's this hub of, you know, youthful determination and ideas, and then you walk into the next room and there's like the sort of, oh, there's the Royal Bank of Scotland sector, and there's Barclay, and there's all these other, you know, greenwashing areas, and it's just like, oh, how, this is very strange. But yeah, it was a fascinating experience.
I suppose if we're positive about it, if the big corporates feel the need to greenwash, at least they understand that there's a public feeling about it.
Yes. Yeah.
What they're doing, some of it, what they're doing is nonsense, but you know, yeah. At least they feel the need to engage, which is, whereas...
instead of just deny.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being involved in environmental stuff when I was school and post-school, a young person. We were just treated as being mad. Mm. Just, you know, you're crazy. What's wrong with all these cars? What's wrong with all this stuff?
Yeah. We've certainly come a long way.
Yeah, so it has come a long way. So what's with football with you?
Well, I loved football growing up, but then I sort of just discovered music and kind of lost touch with it. Really, I was a Spurs fan. I'm sure you're unfortunately
here. Well, but, you're in the wrong part of London for that. But I know what you mean. It's all right.
I think we had a few friends that got involved with St Albans City Football Club, and it sort of introduced me to the fact that football isn't all like the stuff we see in the big leagues, the sort of corruption, that it was the money, it's just all a bit icky. And there's this, you know, underlying, I suppose, sense of like realness of what football should be, which is taking it back, you know, to what it was. And it was much more about community and bringing the community together. So we were like, wow, that's what we do music for, essentially. And so here's this parallel. And so it's kind of a obvious for us, really, just to get involved in any way that we could.
Well, Abramovich departing the football scene in a bit of a hurry, presumably to hide away on a big yacht somewhere. I think this is a big turning point. So maybe at last the football industry will wake up to where Abramovich's money came from, to the Saudi Arabian ownership of Newcastle and others. And maybe this will be the impetus for more democratic ownership of clubs like yours. And then you look at clubs that are on sale and their supporters are just spectators in the sale process. I want it to be democracy where fans elect the board.
Yeah. Yeah.
Accountable to the board. Criticise the board. Yeah. What's wrong with that?
You'd feel much more in touch with like the real essence of the club, wouldn't you? You'd feel.
Yeah. I mean, I go to Arsenal games and obviously local club support and so on, but you're in this massive stadium, it feels very corporate. It's much nicer going to a smaller game somewhere else.
Yeah.
So do you think we can make football more community-owned, more democratic? Do you think it's possible?
I don't know. I'm not holding my breath. I think, you know, because still the profit motive is hard to destroy, isn't it, really? So I think there'll always be that just underlying urgency there, which may, unless there's like a full revolt and like the people demand, you know, like public ownership, I would be shocked to see it happening. But, you know, start with these small clubs, work a way up, you know, who knows?
Well, I think that's right. You start with the small clubs and build up from there. And it, to me, football at its best is a training for young people in understanding collective. I mean, much as every striker thinks they win every game, and much as every goalkeeper thinks they save every game, the reality is it's 11 players working together. So it's a lesson in teamwork for young people. And that to me is one of the beauties of football.
Absolutely.
And so, but as you say, the money motive is so huge there, it's not going to be easy to overturn that. But can I ask you one last thought? You're doing fantastic work in music and you give this political commentary all the time. Do you feel that socialist ideas, left ideas and collective ideas are under more or less attack in the sort of cultural sphere that you work in at the moment?
I think probably in the younger generations, far, far less attack, because I think to most people, young people who don't feel any sense of like ownership of the current system, they've just been sort of born into it and they're like looking around themselves and they're seeing the intense environmental problems, they're seeing all the social problems and they're going, what's going on here? This system doesn't look like it works. So I think people are just being drawn to new ideas. And, you know, after decades of neoliberalism, I think left-leaning ideas are new to the youth. And ideas that go past like any sense of like productivism. So like ideas that just disregard growth and like call it what it is, which is a sort of form of insanity and actually not efficient, not economical, not sustainable. I think people are sort of logically, you know, embracing new ideas and new discussions. But then saying that, I think perhaps in older generations, there feels like there's a lot of attack, I think, in terms of those ideas, because I think they see that it's so hard to justify and support the system the way it is, like the whole socio-economic system, really. So I think the more and more people question, the more and more there's going to be fight back against it from the sort of status quo, the guardians of the status quo. So it's you know, interesting, polarized, hostile times. But I think hopefully there's a lot of new ideas and new thinking that's going to come out.
I find young people much more open to radical ideas on the economy than older people. When you say, for example, if we want to protect the natural world and the environment, I mean, I hate the word biodiversity, and by the end of our conversation, I'm sure we'll have replaced it with something more appropriate. But if you talk to them about that, they recognize that if you have a free market economic system, which is based essentially on the ever increasing rapidity of drawing natural resources out of the earth, then you have a problem. You have a problem with what you've done to the air environment, you've had a problem what you've done to the ground environment, and you've got yourself a problem. But older people find it very hard to see beyond the sort of profit motive in the economy and how you live your life. Whereas I find younger people much more open to the idea, well, actually, the world in the words of the Diggers, is a common treasury, and there is enough for all of us, but there isn't enough for the greed. So you then talk about things like universal basic income. You talk about giving everybody a reasonable standard of living. You talk about a society that genuinely cares for all in a world that works on those principles, and you begin to get a bit of a hearing. Now, I tell you what's inspired me has been the United States, to me, has always been a place of wonder and fear because of the rampant free market capitalism of the United States. But who would have thought that Bernie Sanders, describing himself as a socialist in a country that went through the McCarthy era and everything else, would come within a hair's breadth of being the Democrat candidate for president and quite possibly president instead of Donald Trump. You know, and so something happened there that a lot of mainly young people growing up in a free market society saw something different.
Yeah, I think that's it. Just shows that those sort of like what we were speaking about earlier about the little chipping away steps, you know, you have the Occupy movement who are just like, start asking questions, and then those questions become mainstream questions. And then the next minute you have a mainstream politician, as you say, becoming very, very close. And these ideas are now...
I think you'd be a bit upset if you call him a mainstream politician.
Well,
Bernie, if you're listening, it's meant as praise.
not derogatory, but means. But yeah, it's fascinating times because new ideas are being discussed. And we have one of our songs is called TINA, an acronym for There Is No Alternative, which is this, you know, phrase that we've heard again and again over the decades. And I think people now just going, well, hold on a minute, there has to be, because there's just completely, you know, all the trajectories aren't looking very good. So there has to be alternatives. So people just aren't buying it anymore. They're much more scared of what will happen if we stay with this status quo than the fear of the new, of the novel or whatever.
And some of the groups that got together during COVID, the mutual aid groups and so on, I think have made a big difference because they've suddenly people woken up, hang on, my neighbour was very hungry, I didn't know that. There are people sleeping rough around here, I didn't know that. And they've sort of woken up to their own injustice, and that's been seen on a global scale. And also the reaction to refugees is varied. Sometimes it's totally horrible, but there are 70 million refugees around the world. There's now another million have come from Ukraine. Well, they're all people. They've got to be supported. So we've got to think about why and how they became refugees rather than the brutality of the treatment of so many. There's that Bob Dylan song, isn't it? I Pity the Poor Immigrant. It's quite powerful, actually, that, So, music is the message, and art, to me, is... I call music art as well. It is art. Yeah. Is the excitement of people being imagining things for the future. And our project here, the Project for Peace and Justice, which you're sitting under the splendid banner of, is about being an umbrella for people, an umbrella from which they can develop activities and ideas, solidarity, actions, solidarity with people taking action to improve their world, but above all, empowering people. Your music empowers.
I like to think so. Yeah, we try and do our bit.
And what's next?
What's next? Well, we're trying to figure out touring again, basically, you know, as we're able to start playing shows again. We did a UK tour in December, which went really well, and we've got some festivals this summer. Then we've got an American tour, Australia, Europe. So it's basically I've become a full-time touring musician again very soon.
So how do you write when you're on tour?
It's much more difficult. Yeah, that's much more the crazy, constantly distracted, you know, trying to find a quiet room backstage kind of world.
Or if you're right, do you travel by bus between events or what?
A bit of everything. Yeah, bus, a train.
So you're not, when you're on a train, you don't get an idea of a song, you know, do you?
I'm you know, you've got the voice note apps, you're constantly sort of diddle-deeing into an app, any ideas that will hit you on the road. But
yeah. You don't feel self-conscious, so you're at the core of the trade. Say,
it's not something I'd release. Me just, you know, beatboxing or singing a melody in a quiet carriage in a bus. No, but you know, they're the little stems of the seeds of new ideas. So.
Well, can I say thank you very, very much for coming here today and having a chat with us, and good luck with it all. But people don't always realise that what they're doing is part of a movement. You don't have to be a card-carrying member of anything to be part of a movement. Mm. You're part of a movement if you're doing something.
Absolutely.
It's a movement of activities and activists.
Just showing some empathy is a
well. That's a good start.
Seems to be part of a movement against things at the moment. But yeah,
thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Peace and Justice podcast. Find out more about what you heard in this episode by going to thecorbynproject.com/podcast. There you can sign up to support our campaign, and if you can, become a regular supporter to help fund our work for peace and justice in this country and around the world. Solidarity, and catch you next time.